Bruce Knapp, your host on Worldwide UFO News Radio. Strange days indeed.
Program 223 of these strange days indeed. The program that looks at the phenomena that surround the phenomenon of unidentified flying objects. And as you hear constantly every week on this program, there are some very strange phenomena that surround unidentified flying objects. A lot of things that are attributed to UFOs. Not everybody in the field agrees that what is attributed to UFOs is, in fact, what's going on. But who really knows what's going on and why? And that's why this program exists. In studio with me is Bobby Rowley, Dean Gwilandi out there in the control room. Joining us from her home in San Rafael, California, is an investigative journalist and broadcaster, Leslie Kane. Leslie Kane is the associate producer and co-host of an investigative news program on public radio station KPFA in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's also written investigative features, news analyses, and opinion pieces for the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Sacramento Bee, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the Nation, the Providence Journal, and the International Herald Tribune, the Globe and Mail here in Canada, the Vancouver Sun, the Sydney Morning Herald, the Kyoto Journal, and many, many other print media. She's also authored books, anthologies and collections, Perspectives, Drugs and Society, Henry Hyde's Moral Universe, Where More Than Time and Space Are Warped, Stone Soup for the World, and Drug Society and Behavior, and a lot of other books, including Burma's Revolution of the Spirit, The Struggle for Democratic Freedom and Dignity, co-authored with Alan Clements. Not often do you get someone with the background that Leslie Kane has. Take a look at what we talk about here on this program every week. Leslie, I want to welcome you to this program, first of all.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
I have to say that reading your credentials on the radio, it kind of takes my breath away because you've done an enormous amount of work over the years.
Well, I've done a lot of work in areas that aren't related to this subject.
Well, exactly. So what does a journalist, broadcaster, with your background, go through to come into this field?
Well, the subject of UFOs has been a personal interest of mine for a long time, actually even before I started doing serious journalism. But I never thought that I could ever do anything with it professionally. It never would have occurred to me until this report came out of France, which I wrote my first story about on the subject in the Boston Globe, the Cometa Report. Just because I had this personal interest and my curiosity about the subject had been growing, and then when this report came out, I felt confident enough as a journalist to recognize that maybe if anything was ever going to get in the mainstream media on this subject and be taken seriously, maybe this could be it.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the nature of the people that wrote it. Because I had the solid background that you just referenced, I felt secure enough to try and take this into the mainstream, you know, because I felt that I had already had relationships with a lot of editors that I'd worked with prior to this. So I just decided to see if I could do it, and I think if this Cometa report had not come out at the time that it did, maybe it never would have happened.
Mm.
It was just so significant to me, and I felt it was very newsworthy, and I decided to just approach it with the same level of journalism that I had approached every other subject that I published on.
Now, the Cometa report is a study by French officials, the routine unexplained sightings, U.S. military safety aspects, and was put together by a really, when you look at their credentials, an interesting group of former military and government people in France.
Absolutely. And we have to clarify that they're not officials in the sense that they were not part of the government. They were mostly retired people, although there were some government representatives that contribute to the report.
Yeah,
but it's very important to make it clear that nobody is claiming that this is a report from the government of France. But they were very, very high-level people, for instance, a four-star general. And again, this man was a former commander of the French Technical Air Force. He was a counselor to the Prime Minister of France. Also included was the former head of the National Center for Space Studies, which is the equivalent of our NASA. They had the National Chief of Police involved. They had another three-star admiral involved. The head of a, and they did have a head of a government agency, which has been studying UFOs for decades. Another one is a famous Air Force pilot in France. A lot of retired military people. So when you consider who these people were and that they did this three-year study, they wrote a 90-page report, and they came to the conclusion that a percentage, and they estimated about 5%, of these sightings for which there is adequate data to determine that they are actually anomalous, that they have characteristics of an object, you know, a maneuverable, luminous object that we can't identify, that they thought the extraterrestrial hypothesis was the most logical explanation for these objects. And to me, the fact that these folks, folks at that level made a statement like that was extremely significant. You can imagine if the equivalent people in Canada made that kind of a statement, or the equivalent people in the United States, you know, came out with this kind of a statement, it would certainly make news.
Yes. Unfortunately, there's a tendency to write it off to Gallic temperament.
But to me, it was news, and I really approached this, as I said, from the perspective of a journalist. Is this newsworthy? Is this something that the people need to know about, that people would be interested to know about? You know, it's my job to bring information to people, and I know there's a tremendous interest in this subject. People are denied information in the media, and this, to me, was something that they had a right to know about.
A lot of agencies picked up on that particular article that you wrote on the Cometa Report.
Well, a few did. I mean, what happened was I finally got it into the Boston Globe, but it was very, very difficult to get it anywhere. And again, I went to editors who I had published with in the past who liked my work, but when they heard what the subject was, most of them didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot in this process about the level of ridicule that exists, the level of denial that exists, and just plain lack of informed editors. People in the media are not informed about the subject, and they've basically just been exposed to tabloids. So, you know, why should they take it seriously? But fortunately, I had an editor in the Globe who I'd written for maybe five or six times before. She really liked my work. She was an open-minded person, and she worked with me over a period of months, literally, on the edits, in making herself get comfortable with it. I mean, this was a huge thing for a major paper to take on a story that had anything to do with UFOs. So right till the last moment, I never knew if I'd get it published. And then once it was published by the Globe, it was picked up a few other places.
Was it not distributed by the New York Times wire service?
Yes, it was. You're correct about that. And it may have been picked up in some places that I don't even know about, because when something goes out on the wires, you don't know where it ends up. But I know it was picked up in Minneapolis. I think it was the Minneapolis Star Tribune and a couple of other small papers that I'm aware of. And then I ran a longer version of it, actually, in the Irish Independent, which, and their weekend magazine. They did a big spread with pictures, and it was also picked up in a magazine in France. Well, the other interesting thing to me, though, was that the Early Bird, which is the Pentagon Daily, it's a Pentagon newspaper that goes out to the military all over the world. It's an international publication. They published the whole story in their thing called the Early Bird. So I thought that was kind of interesting that they thought it was important enough to send it around to the military to read.
That is interesting, and it adds interest to it for us here in the studio, is that we were talking during one of the breaks about the number of hits the Virtually Strange Network's website takes, and looking at the breakdowns of the various servers that hit it. The large number of .mil and .gov websites that come through.
Yeah, I think there's more interest there among people than, because they're just very quiet about it. But there's probably more interest than we think.
You would think with the way that employers keep an eye on their employees and what they do with their time during office hours, there would be a reluctance, particularly in government and in the military, to come visit sites like the Virtually Strange Network.
Right, especially after, maybe after 9-1-1, where they're monitoring emails even more closely
even
than
more
they were
so,
before.
Even more so. Leslie, with the Cometa Report, was there anything that, that made your eyebrows stand up as you went through it?
There was quite a lot, actually. I think that their descriptions of the objects, here's one that I love. It says, and they're talking about this 5% that I mentioned that can be clearly established as being unknown. He said, they seem to be completely unknown flying machines with exceptional performances that are guided by a natural or artificial intelligence. That sense really got to me. And then just reading them, reading the words that they believe that the extraterrestrial hypothesis is the best explanation for the phenomena. And here's another line. They say, although not categorically proven, strong presumptions exist in its favor, and if it is correct, it is loaded with significant consequences. That'll make your hair stand up a little.
Yeah, and coming from a group of former military and former civil servants over there in France, you have to say to yourself, well, these aren't a bunch of people running around with aluminum foil hats on their heads.
Exactly. These are not the man on the street. This is, again, as I said, a four-star general, a three-star admiral, a chief of police, a head of a space agency in France. And the fact that it's a lot of people who came together is also very significant. There were scientists involved as well, and engineers.
Mm.
So I thought the whole thing was astounding. And then their analysis of why they say it is, what the consequences might be. There's a lot of philosophical analysis about religious implications, and they go the whole spectrum, and they also look in depth at some very significant cases for which there's physical evidence. So that they cover a lot of ground in the report. I encourage people to, anybody that doesn't have it, to get a copy. It's not easy to get, unfortunately.
No, it hasn't been officially translated into English, I understand.
Well, it actually has. The Fund for UFO Research was authorized by the Comita Group to translate it, and they received a grant to do that.
Right.
But they have not been authorized to publish it. And so,
which is very odd.
It's hard to acquire. Unfortunately, it's not on the Internet, and it should be. I think we should somehow try to get permission to put it up there, because we were actually given permission by this group to distribute the report at an event in Washington, D.C. this fall that I was involved with, and I was astounded that they gave us that permission.
Mm.
So they may now be willing to let us put it up on the website, and I think I'm just thinking out loud now. I think I'm going to try to do that so people can read it.
Mm-hmm. I know that Stanton T. Friedman had some copies of it, which he was making available for the cost of photocopying, basically.
That's right, and he's still doing that, and people can get in touch with him for copies. That's absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm. But a lawyer in France actually wrote to the UFO updates list suggesting that he cease and desist.
I know he did get a call like that, but I don't think he has ceased and desisted, but I may be wrong on that, so I don't want to get Stan in any trouble here, but I suggest that people could get in touch with him and just see if he's still doing this.
And, of course, you can get hold of Stanton Friedman at www.virtuallystrange.net and go to the links, and you'll find a link to Stanton Friedman's page there. Or you can do a search for him in the UFO Updates archives.
Another very important point that they made in this report, Errol, is continuously, first of all, they challenged the United States on its level of secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
And, it really made the point that here we are, the superpower of the world. And they addressed numerous concerns about us being sort of the culprits when it comes to secrecy on this issue. They also recommended that the European Union become involved, that this be taken on as an issue of international importance, and that countries of the world come together and study it,
mm-hmm.
take it seriously. And I thought both of those points were extremely important and very well stated in the report.
Leslie Kane, do you know how the French government reacted to this report?
So all I know is that a report was given to the Prime Minister and to the President of France, but as far as I know, they have not made any public response to it.
Mm.
So I don't think a whole lot that we know about happened, either here or in France,
mm.
to say the truth. But we, of course, don't know what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, when you don't know, don't do anything.
Yeah.
It's the way it seems to work. You moved from the Comita report, and that sort of established your name. I think that's when a lot of UFO people, UFO researchers, became very aware of you. You did the Comita report, and then what did you look at as far as an investigative journalist is concerned?
The next thing I looked at was a study that came out by Dr. Richard Haynes, who I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. He's a retired aerospace scientist from NASA Ames Research Center. He lives in California. And he, as many of you may know, has been studying pilot reports of encounters with these objects. He calls them UAP, which stands for Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, which really covers a broader spectrum than just what we think of as UFOs.
Yeah, I think he also uses that so as not to make the UFO side of the subject pronounced, I think.
Right, which is what a lot of scientists feel compelled to do just because of the problems of being associated with the UFO phenomena, and I understand that. the desire to do that because of all the attitudes we have to deal with in the scientific community about the subject. He published a very interesting report in, and I did a, my next story was exactly a year after the Boston Globe. It came out in May of 2001, in which I looked at this report he did, and he heads up an organization called the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, which is abbreviated NARCAP.
Mm-hmm.
And in this study called Aviation Safety in America, a Previously Neglected Factor, he looked at cases of pilot encounters with UFOs, or UAP, I should say, in which there were aviation safety issues raised. Now, this would mean that pilots had near misses with objects, or they had to do sudden maneuvers to avoid colliding with objects,
mm-hmm.
that their instruments may have been affected by the presence of something there that was affecting the magnetic compasses or putting their communication systems out of whack. And he collected about 100 very well-documented cases and made the point that this should be looked at by the aviation community, if only to deal with the possibility that if pilots are uninformed about the phenomena, that there's a greater risk that something might happen someday that could be serious.
Yeah.
And his point is that because it does represent an aviation safety hazard, that pilots should not be afraid to talk about it, which they are mostly, and there should be an education process that should go on about it.
And they're not sort of nebulous things that the pilots think they see. They've seen distinct objects out there.
Very clearly. In some of the reports they filed, you talk about your hair standing on end, you know. Just to look at some pilot who's been flying for 30, 40 years, and, you know, these are not quacks, you know. They're the most highly skilled, highly trained observers we have.
And highly regarded within their companies.
Absolutely, and they're up there in the sky, so they have a unique position to view these objects because they're closer than we usually are on the ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have documented extraordinary things up there. Some of them report things with windows, with what look like portholes, and I have read some of these reports in their own handwriting, and it really is just remarkable.
The organization is for not only pilots, but also for air traffic control and control tower operators, radar operators, who can report almost anonymously to this website.
Yeah, they have a whole form that, as you just said, anonymously acquire this form and then turn it in. And by doing that, any people are contributing to the research that's being going on, as well as encouraging others to not be so concerned about ridicule and all the other risks that people perceive
mm-hmm.
they'll be taking. But it's NARCAP.org, the website, by the way.
Right. And Don Ledger, who was on this program a little earlier, is the Canadian rep up here.
Mm-hmm.
People who listen to this program like to hear the stories and the reports. With the article that you wrote on NARCAP for the Providence Journal, Pilot Encounters with UFOs, the Study Challenges Secrecy and Denial, you started to get into a story or two, the hair raisers.
You mean some of the ones I mentioned in the story?
Yes.
Yeah, because again, and some of these are detailed in Richard Haynes' report, which of course is on the NARCAP website, but one of my favorites, which I particularly liked because I was able to see the report that this guy wrote with his own hand. This happened in 1981. He was a TWA captain, and a lot of this I couldn't even get in the story because you never have enough space, but he's got incredible credentials. I think he was a fighter pilot in Korea, you know, a real American hero type with a lot of flying hours. And he was flying over Lake Michigan in 81, and he described something so close to him that he was able to see what he called large, round, silver metal object was how he described it, with dark portholes equally spaced around the circumference that descended into the atmosphere from above. And that was how he described this thing. And the one little space you're supposed to check, you know, did you think it was A, B, C, D? They give you all these options of what to check it might be. And then one of them was spaceship. And he clearly marked that. The next question was, do you have any doubt about what you just marked in the previous question? And his answer was no.
Mm.
He did a drawing of it also. He went back into the cockpit of the actual plane from which he saw it. He went in with Dr. Haynes, and they reconstructed the event, and he drew it to scale, you know, as with respect to how big it actually looked in the window when he was looking out.
Yes.
And I have a copy of that drawing, and I, of course, tried to get these newspapers to publish it, but they never had enough space. But, you know, it was so close. The thing just came whipping in, and then it did this sort of little flip, and then it flew away really fast, and it was so close that he was able to see the kind of detail that he described. What was this thing?
Exactly.
And, you know, why should you ignore the pilot's interpretations just because they think it's something that doesn't correlate with our conventional way of thinking about things? Why deny them the reality of what they saw? If they had said it was some kind of a fighter bomber from Germany or some kind of a Russian spacecraft that was a secret technology or something, nobody would doubt what they were saying as being accurate. But as soon as they say something that's not within our frame of reference, people don't know what to do with it, and so, you know, nobody pays attention. But why shouldn't we?
And then, you get the fatuous explanations like a weather balloon or Venus. Or
right.
That swamp gas was the old one.
I know. He'll never live that one down.
No, poor old Alan Hynek.
But, you know, it's a real dilemma when you see such clear, and this happens over and over. I mean, hundreds, thousands of reports like this over a period of decades that have been accumulated by Dr. Haynes. This is basically ignored.
And ground systems operators, the radar guys and the air traffic controllers, have also made a lot of reports, too.
Correct. And again, I don't know as much about that, but I know you're absolutely right. They have. And of course, in the early cases in the 50s, you know, where it seemed like maybe there was a little more openness about the subject, there were lots of reports of objects being picked up on radar.
Yeah. Well, the one that we recall on this program, because Wendy Connors supplied us with an audio recording of a TV show from back in the 50s, and that was immediately after the Washington, D.C. flap of, I think it was 52.
Mm-hmm.
They had the senior radar control operator from the Washington, D.C. area. He was on this program and talking quite openly about these anomalous blips that they got on their radar even back in those days.
And this was during the flap of 1952, July, the overflight over Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
I'm surprised he was even allowed to talk about it publicly.
Well, back in those days, I don't think that there was the clampdown, because it was the beginning of it all, that the authorities didn't know enough to deny.
True. And that's why I love reading the material from those days.
From the NARCAP and the aerial phenomena article that you wrote, what did you get into next?
Well, next was, I did a piece on crop circles.
Right.
Of course, and this doesn't include, you know, all the stuff that I sort of explore and never actually manifest into an article. There's a lot that goes on when you're a journalist, besides just what you produce, you know.
Yeah, but it serves you in good stead, because you have gotten into some interesting things of late, which we will get into, but crop circles.
I did a piece on crop circles, and this one came out in September of 2002. Fairly recently, I sort of decided to ride the wave of the movie Signs that came out and the Gizecki documentary that came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been interested in the work of the BLT research group for quite a while, and it just sort of seemed to me that that was the time to do the story, because there was going to be a lot of interest in the subject as a result of the film. So basically what I did was I did a story that looked at the science that had been done on the study of crop circles.
Right.
And the serious science. They published peer-reviewed papers and different scientists that have explored the issues both here and in the United Kingdom. But also, we've got the Dutch researcher Elcho Hasselhoff that a lot of people are familiar with. So I just sort of laid out an overview of what I thought the best science was and what the conclusions are, where the scientific research stands. It was really interesting to me that when Signs did come out, all the newspapers did their own pieces on crop circles, and it was just so painful for me to read them, because they were very shallow and basically just explored the issue of whether the hoaxers were right or the true believers were right. It completely ignored the scientific studies that have been done on crop circles.
And there's been some mind-boggling discoveries about the structural changes.
Both in the plants.
In the plants,
yeah, I mean,
and the soil.
Absolutely fascinating that there have been, as you mentioned, you know, structural changes in plants and the stems, having to do with what appears to be a microwave energy that heats up the internal moisture in the plants, and then they basically explode the way they would in a microwave oven, or they just become so stretched out, and you can visually see this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also effects on seeds. You know, they'll take the seeds from the crop circle, and germinate them under the same conditions that they would experience in nature, and then the control seeds are ones that are outside the formation but in the same field. And so they make these comparisons, and they've seen all kinds of changes in the seeds, from, you know, massive speeding up of the growth to no growth at all, depending on the conditions of the plants and the stage of their growth and so on when they get them. It's actually quite complex.
Yes.
And this article was probably the most difficult one I've done, because I had to understand all the science, and it was not easy to do that, and then consolidate it down into a very short, clear piece. But it was extremely fascinating, and to really see that the scientific studies show that these could not possibly all be hoaxed. I mean, that is an absolute fact. And most of the media just sort of missed it. You know, they didn't bother to look. But because of the changes that are clearly found in these plants, and this doesn't mean all of them, but it doesn't have to be a lot to be significant.
Yeah.
There's no way that boards and planks, anyway, could be creating them. In fact, some of them are even found in plants that are still left standing. People think, well, they've got the boards and the planks, and they're flattening the ground out, right? But these are changes that are found in plants that are left standing within the circles. And so there are also changes that are found in these kind of randomly downed areas. There's not even really a geometric design. They'll just sort of be splotches of downed plants and fields. And, you know, obviously nobody would bother to hoax those. And these same changes are found in those situations. So we know there is some kind of energy at work here that's making this happen. And scientists are actually really baffled about what it is at this point.
When you get changes in the structure that could only be caused by, what were the, Nancy?
Well, a microwave
Nancy
is what
Talbot,
it looks like.
Yeah, Nancy Talbot was on this program, I guess, a year or so ago now. And we had talked to her just after she'd come back from Holland and had those incredible experiences where blue beams of light came down outside her bedroom window.
Right, she actually witnessed the formation of one.
Yeah, exactly. But she was saying that some of the temperatures required to cause these changes, both in the plants and the soil, would have turned the plants themselves to ashes.
That's right, and that's one of the things that's so remarkable. And, you know, I don't know if they had done this actual, the study, when you had her on. You know, they have since put out a report that was funded by Rockefeller about study of this crop circle in Canada. I don't know if she would have talked about that one or not.
No, at that time
they looked at the clay mineral changes.
Mm-hmm.
And this study has been rubber stamped by the leading scientist in the world on clay mineralogy, and he was president of the Clay Mineral Society. He's a very distinguished academic from Dartmouth College who has every paper and PhD you could ever want. You know, he's the leading expert in the field, and he's reviewed all the data and said that all their methods were sound, and that this he's utterly baffled by the results of this study. And basically what the studies show is that the changes in the crystallinity and changes in the plant stems are synchronized, so that they increase, you know, towards the center of the circle, they go outward, and they're the same, you know, in the same increments, so that it appears that they're caused by the same energy source, because they're linked, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So because they're correlated in that way, you have to assume that first, that the energy source that created them is the same, but the levels of heat that are required to make the changes in the crystallinity that are observed are so high that, as you said, they would destroy any plants. And so this fellow, Dr. Reynolds, who is the leading expert in the field, says this is some kind of an unknown energy. He cannot explain what it is. Bottom line is there's no question that it's not people with ropes and planks that are doing this.
Yeah, it's not Doug and Dave after a couple of pints of cider. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, the media had a field day with Doug and Dave.
Yes.
You know, that's all they talked about in these articles.
Mm-hmm.
Including, I don't know if you saw Barbara Walters on 2020. Did you guys get that in Canada?
Yes, we do, but I didn't see that one.
Anyway, it was just the same thing, and they didn't spend 1 second of their 20-minute report on this looking at the science of crop circles. They just went to England and interviewed the hoaxers and then concluded that they were all man-made. So that was the program.
Well, yeah, but that's the easy way out, too, isn't it? And especially when you've got Doug and Dave's and those other people out in England who...
You've got the artists. I think there's a guy named John Lundgren who's sort of become famous for what he calls his art.
When you look at some of those images, they're absolutely gorgeous.
I agree.
You know, you want to print them out and blow them up real big and hang them on the wall. They're just works of art. But are all those John Lundgren? I mean, does he have the time to run around Britain and make all of those? I don't know.
I don't know. And I think the other countries, in a way, are even more interesting because Canada and other places seem to have less of a focus on this sort of art, what they call artists. So, I mean, there's no question that some of them are not man-made, and we still don't know what's creating them or how they're created. And that's the status, and it's unfortunate that there's not more resources being given to scientists to study crop circles and other related things.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Leslie, I got an email here from Michel Deschamps up there in Sudbury, where allegedly the actual moon landing happened.
Moon landing?
Yes.
You mean that's where the supposed staged one was?
Yeah, apparently. Well, that's where the astronauts trained for the moon landing before they actually went to the moon. But up there in Sudbury is the Mutual UFO Network of Ontario's Sudbury Section Director, Michel Deschamps. And Michel says in an email here, from what I'm hearing, I can tell that Leslie will pave the way for others in her field to do the same excellent work that she's doing.
Well, I appreciate it, and I hope it's true, because one of my dreams is, of course, to get other journalists to look at these subjects, and I'm communicating with them and doing that all the time as much as I can. So I certainly hope that it comes to pass.
Mm-hmm. And the laughter in the background there was from a regular contributor to this program. John Velez joins us from New York City. I told you, they're listening all over the world. John Velez, welcome back.
Hi, Errol. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, John. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice, too.
Yeah, John and I met recently.
I called
recently
in because I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask, but I want to preface my questions by saying that I had the privilege of meeting Leslie and spending several hours with her in Washington, D.C. late last year when we both attended the symposium at George Washington University that was produced by CFI, Podesta Mattoon, and the Sci-Fi Channel, and that along with the fact that she happens to be a very bright and accomplished lady, I can vouch for the fact that she's also a very sweet person as well. And it's a pleasure to hear her on the program tonight, and I'd like to say that I agree with Michelle's sentiments completely.
There.
I don't know what to say to that.
Yeah.
Shut your mouth. Leslie, I have two questions for you. One is business-related and one is kind of personal.
Okay.
The business question is, because I had the chance to meet you at the symposium in Washington, I was wondering if you had any new information or any information that you can share with the rest of us about the CFI, Podesta Mattoon, Sci-Fi Channel initiative in regard to the Freedom of Information Act.
Sure. Now, do you want me to, Errol, explain a little bit about what that is, first of all?
Well, we've been covering it up here for weeks and weeks and weeks. But for those of our listeners who've just joined us and have no idea what we're talking about, please do.
Okay, and I'll just try to keep it really brief.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the website address is freedomofinfo.org, so people can go there and see what it is. It's basically a coalition that has been formed to try to improve the climate for scientists so we can get more scientific credibility and resources established so that we can get Congress interested, and we want to improve the media coverage, and those are sort of the three goals that we have. And we have been working with a firm called Podesta Mattoon, which John just mentioned, which is a public relations and government communications firm very well established in Washington, D.C.
And you need to mention that John Podesta of Podesta Mattoon was President Clinton's chief of staff. Yes.
He actually is not part of Podesta Mattoon, but he shares the name. His brother, Anthony Podesta, is one of the co-runners of Podesta Mattoon, and that's why we were able to, I think, get him interested. But he's actually an attorney now. He's at Georgetown. I think he does teach at Georgetown University. So we're very fortunate to have his support. And the initiative that John just mentioned is a FOIA effort that we launched in October.
Freedom of Information Act.
Freedom of Information Inquiry, and we have the backing of a very well-established Washington law firm, actually. Again, all of this has been made possible because of the resources of the Sci-Fi Channel,
mm-hmm.
who are basically backing and funding and supporting this initiative. And they've hired the law firm Lobel, Novens, and Lamont to work with me to launch this FOIA initiative that we intend to take as far as we possibly can, which is take it into court if we have to. And what our target is so far is the Kexburg case, which happened in December 9th, 1965. We probably don't have time to go into that in great detail,
Errol did a whole program on
you did it last week, right?
Case.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So people know about it, and if they want more, they can go to Stan Gordon's website, who you had on last week, or they
right.
can go to my website. That's
or they can...
information. There's information there, too.
Yes, and right off the Strange Days Indeed
there's
program page, yes.
So we have posted an update, John. I think I put it up there in December, which really gives you the current status of where the inquiry is at. We've gotten back the first round of responses, but there's even some first round letters that haven't gone out yet that we've... I've learned more about where we need to send the letters as I've researched the case more. And there were some letters that unfortunately didn't go out that were supposed to go out. So we're kind of still at the early stages here, but we're going to start moving it along more quickly now, and we know more about where to go, and we're determined, and the Sci-Fi Channel is committed to follow this through this year. And I think this year we're going to see some pretty exciting things happening around this FOIA initiative and also with some other programs that are now under consideration. So this effort that you've seen this fall is going to continue for the next year.
I don't know if you're aware of Stephen Bassett's latest project.
I just read the press release. That's
mm-hmm.
all I know is what I've seen on the press release.
Mm-hmm. We had him on here earlier on talking about that project and that press release and his new website. And he is looking for sponsorship for that project. So whatever anybody can do to help that move along as well, because I think that is worthwhile.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know anything about
it. Web address for CFI so that listeners can go check out the website.
Yeah, again, it's on www.freedomofinfo.org.
And a lot of your work is there.
That's right. A lot of my work is there. And as I said, we're right now in the process of assessing. We had a big meeting Friday with Podesta Mattoon and Sci-Fi and myself, and we're really launching now a bunch of very important efforts that are going to happen this year. We don't know exactly what they are yet, but they're all formulating right now. So we appreciate ideas that anybody might want to contribute to us, and you'll be hearing some things, I think, over the next few weeks about some things that we're going to do this year. So I'm very excited about the whole thing.
And anything that we can do here on this program to help move all of that forward, we'd be happy to oblige, Leslie.
Thank you very much.
Anything else, John?
Yes, I had one more question, kind of a personal one. Leslie mentioned earlier that her interest in UFOs goes way back in her own history, and I was curious what sparked that interest. Did it have anything to do with either a personal experience or a sighting or anything like that?
You know, I wish it had, John. I have to say I've never had a sighting, at least of anything that I can clearly be sure of. I'm always asking the universe to give me one, but, you know, I'm thinking maybe as a journalist it's better that I don't have one, because then I can at least pretend that I'm objective, right? But you know, the thing that really got me interested was I read Whitley Strieber's book Communion when it first came out. It really wasn't all that long ago.
Wow.
I have to say that I have the greatest respect and admiration for the diligent researchers that have been working for decades on this subject and are very knowledgeable, and it has to do with the frustration of not being given the credibility and the respect that they deserve. And I have to say that I've learned so much from these people, and I continue to learn from them. So I'm really a novice in this, but Whitley Strieber's book just really piqued my interest, and I think that was when it started, and I just kept reading and exploring the subject. That was probably in, I don't know, the mid-80s that it came out.
Mm-hmm.
Like 86, 87.
Something like that. So, yeah. And another thing the Sci-Fi Channel did, of course, this fall was a symposium in New York City on the abduction phenomena, and that was also, I thought, extremely interesting and important.
Yes, and we covered that also. It's amazing what we covered up here that doesn't seem to be covered by any other UFO radio program anywhere on the planet.
I'm so glad you're doing it. I wish more people would.
Yes, and we do too, because we need more people like you and like this program and John Velez and a lot of the vocal, high-profile people. We need more people talking it up.
I certainly did appreciate meeting John in Washington. The feeling is mutual there.
Oh, thank you. Leslie, listen, thank you very much for responding, and I think it's terrific that Errol had you on the program tonight. It's a good thing for the people to get to meet you this way, to hear your voice and to hear you speak.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate that.
Okay, good night, guys.
Good night, John. Thank
good night,
you.
John.
We'll talk to you officially next week.
Yeah, I'm on duty.
All right.
I'll see you then.
Good night. There's, Leslie, one article that we didn't cover off that I think we need to touch on, and that is a splendid piece, Science and the Failure to Investigate Unidentified Aerial Phenomena.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think this is quite a useful thing. This is not an article. It was never published in any newspapers. It's actually a research report that I was commissioned to write by the Sci-Fi Channel, and it was released at a press conference in October in Washington, the one that John Podesta spoke at, the one in which we announced our FOIA, our Freedom of Information effort on Keksberg. And it was basically written as sort of a background piece for the media, for anybody who's interested, to explore the issue of why scientists have not been given more resources. First of all, the fact that they haven't, and all the efforts scientists have made over the decades to try to bring the issue forward and what they've been up against. And I like it because it's a very good piece, I think, for people who really don't know much about the issue and for people who are very skeptical, because everything in this piece is footnoted. You know, I've only used thoroughly documentable hard facts to look at the issue and to look at some of the most important cases, and the cases that I cite are cases that have been released through government documents and sources like that. It's just sort of a good all-round background, and I've given it to people who didn't recognize the significance of the UFO issue, and their eyes have really been opened by it. And, you know, it's not material that's brand new to people who are experts or who are very well versed in the field.
Yes.
But for people who aren't, and my job, of course, is to reach those people. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm reaching a certain audience here, a sophisticated audience who is skeptical and really doesn't even believe that there's even objects in the sky, let alone everything else that we know about the UFOs. So I do recommend it for people who want something to give to people, who want something to read that sort of gives a good overview, and I believe is very convincing as to the solid evidence that we have for something that's going on here and for the role that scientists need to play in investigating it. That's on the website, by the way.
Yes.
Again, that's the only place you're going to find it, is at www.freedomofinfo.org.
Right, and it's also linked from this program's
webpage. Exactly.
It's out there as a PDF file, so you don't have to do anything. Just go there and print it.
You can get it direct from your website, so you don't have to look for it on the website if you just go that way.
Yeah, and it's all printed and laid out, and I think it's about what?
Well, when you print it all out, it's 27 pages.
27 pages,
yeah. Includes footnotes, and then I attached a little, an unpublished essay by Hynek at the very end that I really love. It's one of my most favorite pieces ever written on the subject, called The Roots of Complacency. So if you include that in the footnotes, you've got 27 pages.
And absolutely worth going and printing out and photocopying and handing out, because it needs to be done. And if you have people who work in media who haven't heard this program, you know you have connections, then pass it on to them. Pass it on to your local politicians, to your provincial politicians, and to your federal politicians. Let them look at it, too, because it's a wonderful backgrounder for the uninitiated.
Well, thank you, and I just hope it's useful in that way, and I think it has been so far.
It has. It's served CFI well. Certainly it's served the Sci-Fi Channel well. And I think in the long run, it will serve the field well, too.
I hope that's correct. As I mentioned briefly earlier, we were very happy to have the panel that the event that John Vela's mentioned in Washington, D.C., where we did bring together scientists in the field, and this was a good backgrounder for that. But that was a very, very exciting event in Washington, which maybe we can talk about another time, and you've probably already talked about it on your program.
Have, and John actually managed to lay his hands on a couple of the kits from that and mailed those up here for the guys who work this program at various times of the month. It was wonderful because we got not only what was said by the people on the panel, but the illustrations that they used, too. So that was
good.
Really good.
Excellent. That's great.
And you know what, Leslie? How about this? Can we get together on a regular basis and find out what's going on with you, what you're looking at, what you're working on?
Absolutely. I'd be honored to be part of that. Sure. We can do that. And especially maybe, you know, after I get clear, as I said, we're in the process now of deciding what some of our focuses are going to be this year. And when we get that clear, I'd love to come on and let people know what we're doing.
Good. And then let's do that. And obviously, we'll know as things are starting to coalesce for you, and the organization will get the publicity, we'll get the releases on it.
Okay.
So
we'll keep in touch by email.
Good. Yeah, let's do that. I want to thank you a lot for being with us tonight, Leslie.
Well, I thank you for inviting me. I was very pleased, and it was enjoyable to be on your show, Errol.
And thank you for your work, and just so glad that you just decided there was a hole that needed to be filled, and you've come in and just done an admirable job of filling.
Well, I hope I can bring others along with me.
Well, yes. That's also part of the work, too, isn't it?
Yes.
Look forward to talking to you again. Thanks for being with us, Leslie, and good luck with it all.
Thank you very much, Errol. I really appreciate that.
And we appreciate you being here.
Okay.
And I'm having trouble saying goodnight again.
And I hope you stay warm there in Toronto.
Oh, we'll try. Wearing heavy clompen boots with felt liners, and the sled dogs are outside waiting to take us home.
Yes, I've been a little shocked by listening to the news reports of the weather, I have to say.
Yes. Well, 23 degrees Fred is fairly cool. As you no doubt know.
Yes, and I won't talk to you about how nice it is in California.
Thank you. Thanks, Leslie.
Okay, do you take care.
And you too. Good night.
Bye.